Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is part two of our interview of Houston Curtis, whose book, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, The A-List Kingpin and the Poker Ring That Brought Down Tinseltown, gives us a very different version of what has been known as Molly's Game. Houston, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back again.
Okay, I forgot to say it last week, but both Richard and I highly recommend this book. Where can people get it?
Great. So I launched a book during the only time in known history where every bookstore in the country is closed.
You're but, just a bundle of good luck these days.
Yeah, just one bad beat after the next. But thankfully, it's still somehow people are finding it. Amazon might be back in stock by now. They ran through the first printing. So we're sending people over to Barnes & Noble. But if you go to my website, if you go to cardsharp.com, and that's cardsharp with a K, I have a direct link to it, to the Barnes & Noble site, which I know has them in stock. And I get like an extra 43 cents on the affiliate dollar if people buy it from me.
There you go.
Yes.
Road to riches.
You get a couple of those and you're up to 86 cents.
Hey, I might even be able to buy a cheeseburger when the restaurants open back up again.
And we will, of course, link to your website and the book and all that once I'm in the show notes for both episodes.
Great.
Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, is cardshark.com the best way?
I would say so, yeah. You can go to CardSharp or email me at, you're going to love this, stacked@cardsharp.com. That is CardSharp with a K.
Uh-huh. All right. So at the end of last week's show, briefly, Jamie Gold's name got mentioned.
Yep.
What was it like playing with him?
Well, one thing I will say about Jamie is this was the game was already, you know, the biggest game in the country for sure by the time Jamie got there. There was one game in New York we heard that played about as big, but they only played once a month. Jamie made the game play even bigger. He kind of took that, his bluffing persona to heart, and he cranked up the action, something fierce, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, and we had a good time with Jamie.
So was this back when he still had the money he had won?
It was. And you know, we definitely benefited from that. But hell, Jamie, you know, one thing, he wasn't shy about ordering like a $3,000 bottle of wine, or something, at the table. You know, he just kind of played like he was a billionaire, and it was a lot of fun. I'll never forget this one hand with him. He had been, you talk about using a little bit of, advantage play or whatever you want to call it. Jamie had been flashing his cards, and I was sitting in a spot where I could see him. And he flashed his cards, the flop came, I saw he had a 6-7 offsuit. The flop came out 8-9-10. I had nothing. I had like Jack Deuce. It wasn't Jack Deuce. I had like Queen Deuce, something like that. No, maybe a gut shot at best. It wasn't 8-9-10. Let me repeat the story. So I see Jamie's cards. He's got a 6-7 offsuit, and the flop came out 8-9 blank. All right. So he had an open-ended straight draw and I had a jack high. That was what the hand was. And everyone else had folded, because Jamie had made a big bet, but I saw his cards. So I was in, I just came in and popped him and, he smooth called me. And then the turn, comes and it's a rag, total rag. And Jamie just pushed all in. And I'm like, how do I make the call without it looking weird, right?
yeah.
So, you know what I mean? So he had been betting open enders a lot through the night. And by the time I was done talking, I was going to make it seem like he'd been betting them every hand, like he had an open ender. So I got up and I said, Jamie, I put you dead on. I'm like, I'm just going to own it, you know. I put you dead on 6-7. You've been betting open-ended straight draws like this all night. I call, and I turned over jack high, and the whole table stood up, like, and gasped. And Jamie was like, damn, Houston. And he turned over the 6-7, and, you know, we ran it out, and I won. But I was like, I guess the only way I can call is I got to just oversell the, you know, craziness of being able to read his hand, you know, like Daniel Negreanu or something. And that's what I did. And I never told him it was because he was flashing his cards, but, it was only like a $40,000 or $50,000 pot, you know, they got much bigger as the night went on, but,
Well, he still had some outs to beat you.
Why not just throw it away? I mean, A, your edge on the hand isn't that enormous, and B,
I also had a flush draw too, so
yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have called with just a flush draw normally, but I had a flush draw and two overs, one over. I had a flush draw and an over card, and I thought it would just be fun to stir up the night a little bit, and I ended up being right because the game went wild that night.
Ultimate bet, Russ Hamilton.
Yes, sir.
You got kind of inadvertently caught up in that, and that screwed you around. Tell us about that.
Before we even get to the ultimate bet part, okay. First was the ultimate blackjack. How did that come about?
Ultimate Blackjack Tour for me started when a young man named Casey Thompson, who I'm sure you guys know, he started All In Magazine. He had partnered with Russ, and Casey and I had spoken right around the time I had launched the Phil Hellmuth DVDs, the Poker Instructional DVDs. That's when we had first met, and he knew I was a television producer, and I guess Russ had, you know, been looking for a television outlet for this new game. And so he, had a meeting with me and, John Moonves, who John had was my entertainment attorney, but he had also partnered with me on the poker DVDs because he's a great poker player and, you know, we both had a passion for poker. So we met with Casey and Russ, and it all started there. And, you know, the wild ride, would get really big and really weird from that point forward.
Yeah. That whole thing was awfully crazy. and I was in Aruba for the event, the night that the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act got signed.
And yeah, I was there. I produced the show there and the Aruba Poker Classic, the poker.
Yeah, and man, it was like a funeral when that happened.
Oh, it was brutal. It was brutal. We were on top of the world before that, you know, and. That, I mean, I think we pulled in like 750K new player signups in week one when the first show aired. And I mean, it was off to the races. You know, the ratings were great. The show looked great. And then it's like, you know, just the world started collapsing.
And now where were you in Molly's game at that point? Was that still going on when that was happening?
Yeah. I was playing in the game. I'd been playing in the game since I think we started the game in 2005. So, you know, UBT was like 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
We produced three seasons. We ended up only airing two, but we produced three.
So, okay, but so that collapsed, and then the cheating scandal happened at Ultimate Bet, and somehow your name was attached to it. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that sucked, especially for a guy with, you know, you now know my true background. Then it was, you know, of course, a complete secret, and it's the last thing in the world I ever wanted to get out. It would have been, you know, devastating. And I wake up one day, I get a call from John Mundes, and he's like, "Are you sitting down?" I was like, "Oh God, what?" And he said, "Well," he said, "Wicked Chops Poker, has just ran a kind of a front page on their site thing saying, is Houston Curtis the cheater behind Ultimate Bet account H_Curtis? And then they went on to say how, we're not saying he is, but we know he's really thick with Russ Hamilton. He's the executive producer of the Ultimate Blackjack Tour. And it sure seems fishy, blah, 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 blah. Well, we got him to take it down that day, just by threatening him with all kinds of legal, you know, lawsuits and stuff. But it didn't matter. You know, at that point, every other side had picked it up. And, you know, so now my name was associated with this list of names that were being looked at in terms of this, God mode, that, Russ was, you know, allegedly charged with using. And you know, it really sucked for me. And then of course it got worse, and I'm sure you'll have a follow-up question, so I'll just let you ask it.
Well, yeah, I mean, so you were not using the account, right? This was an account that had been set up for you at some point?
I was using the account, but I was using it for what just what Russ had. Russ gave everyone in the company an account. I think he put $2,000 in everyone's account. And he just wanted people to play Elimination Blackjack, you know, because we were skinned with UB. And when we launched, we had that site Bet21, which was really the gambling site, and PlayUBT was the free site. And, you know how all that stuff worked. The show was like a, you know, a well disguised infomercial for the online gaming company. And right. So he wanted everybody to be familiar with the game. And so we, you know, would go on and play. But I had never been a big online poker player. Because I never felt I had enough of an edge. so I didn't play much. But it was technically my account. And, well, I don't know how much more I want to say. There may have been some, you know, deposits made to that account in relation to the show at some point. I don't remember. But... where, you know, Russ would put some money into that as opposed to, seeing me in person. And, you know, cause he knew I was basically a professional poker player anyway. So I had to write off, wins and losses on a Schedule C, regardless. So, there was some money transferred through there, but I knew nothing about anything that was going on. And when I was finally made, you know, privy to it, when Russ finally told me a little bit about it, you know, I had heard about, you know, Travis. I don't know how much you guys know about the story.
No, actually, that was my question. Is Russ has always claimed it wasn't him.
Well, Russ had a guy who named Travis who basically did everything for Russ on a computer. You know, I won't say Russ is computer illiterate, but this guy Travis was a computer genius. So he had all of Russ's passcodes, all of Russ's stuff. You know, whenever Russ needed anything done on a computer, Travis would do it. And, you know, just think of it this way. We know that Russ Hamilton is a world class gambler, right? And some may say hustler. You know, you get on a golf course with him, you're going to lose. You play liar's poker with him, you're going to lose. You play poker with him, you know, you're probably going to lose. You're a blackjack table at a casino, you know, they don't want him there. So a guy that's that smart, you know, it just didn't make sense to me that he would put himself in a position to create any kind of pattern that would, if he was involved, that would have come back on him. But if someone else had the account, I could, and they weren't as a world-class gambler like Russ, and they were greedy, and they wanted to get in and make some dough for themselves, well, I could see how that might have screwed some things up for him. I don't know all the truths of it. I don't want to know. But I know this. One thing I'll say about Russ, because a lot of people, you know, they're quick to make up their minds. Russ is an old school guy. You know, I was sitting at the Fix with him at Blasio once, and a guy brings up a $10,000 stack that I guess somebody owed Russ. This kid ran it over to him, and Russ was counting it out. And I have a habit whenever someone's counting money, I count along. It's just something I've always done. So I counted as he was counting in. I counted 9,900, and it was 100 short. And before he could even say anything, I said, Russ, it's 100 short. And he just looked at me and said, Houston, everybody's got to make a living. And that's, you know, that's the kind of the hustler's mentality. And there are so many guys that were doing so much shady stuff during that whole thing that I'm sure that, well, I know Russ could have ratted out, but he didn't, you know, because, you know, there's a certain type of integrity that comes with, you know, even, you know, what do they say? Honor amongst thieves. Russ owes me, you know, the UBT owed me a lot of money. I lost a fortune. But I just have a feeling that somewhere down the road, that he'll find a way to make good on it. That's just my gut.
You know, I find that so many people who cheat are such morons about it that, I mean, and, you know, you bring up a good point. I would think that if Russ were going to cheat, he wouldn't have been so stupid about it.
He's too smart.
Yeah, there's this guy in Northern California, you know, where the card room was doing a TV show and the guy was getting a feed of the
RFID.
And it's, again, like, if people were smart about these things, they could just make millions and millions of dollars over years. But it seems like I know many, not many, but I have run into a lot of cheats over the course of my career. And there are a lot of them that just never want to lose. Not only do they not want to have a losing session, they don't want to lose a hand. You know, it just.
Yeah, greed can get the best of you. But, you know, I think at the same time, it's the guys who lay low, who don't want the exposure, you know, they are out there beating the games, you know, left and right, whether it's from just, you know, guys who are rounders and good players and, you know, have no desire to be famous. They just want to go crush their normal set of games, up to guys who are hitting casinos for millions, but playing it smart.
Yeah, I mean, I know of a guy who was marking cards for 40 years, and the only way they finally caught him was by entrapping him.
Right.
You know, I mean, so the guys who were smart about it are probably still out there doing it and have never been caught.
Were they laying paper down in a casino?
Yep.
Yeah.
The highest levels of poker, which I do want to talk about cheating in poker, but before we get to that, I want to ask you, do you have any worries? Do you have any legal problems still? And or do you have worries about either legal or otherwise about the repercussions of what you've written in the book?
No, you know what? I never wanted to write this damn book. I was approached to write it around the time Molly was writing hers. And I needed the money, but I guess I didn't need it that bad. Cause at that time they were talking about like a 6-figure advance, which now would sound great because, I ended up doing this book, you know, all for back end. I there was no advance and, I don't know if, I would have even been offered a huge advance if I would have demanded one. I just kind of went with the team that I thought would be best to put the book out. And, I just wanted to tell the truth, Richard, you know, I hated seeing, and it's not like in the big scheme of things, no one cares about, you know, the movie Molly's Game, but there's a group of people like us and, you know, people in our circle, in our world that it matters to. And Toby will never admit it. He'll never admit it, but I know it matters to him. And, you know, no one likes to be portrayed as a cheapskate and just a nasty person. I mean, this guy made her a millionaire. For serving cocktails, never gave her a tip less than $1,000 in her life. And he gets made out to be the biggest jerk on the planet.
Oh, yeah. He comes off as a total asshole in the book.
Yeah. And I just thought, man, it just didn't seem right. You know, so I told the truth. And sometimes that truth, you know, might have not always looked great, but it was the truth at least. And
you could have very easily left out your kind of cheating background because it really didn't have much to do with Molly's Game. Why did you decide to include that?
I felt like if I'm going to tell the truth, I might as well tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And the fact is, I never would have got to that game without my past. You know, without the ability to sit and play and Fast Company and to beat Crooked Games and Mobbed Up Games and, you know, in my mid-20s, I walked into a bust out joint that was being set up in my own loft building. And by the end of the night, I was dealing.
Yeah, that story's in the book. It's a good story.
And I just felt like, you know what, it's time for me to, cause I didn't want to ever be considered a hypocrite. Like if it ever did come out, then it's like, oh, Houston claims he told the truth. Well, he didn't really tell the truth because guess what? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just decided I'm going to own it. I'm retired from poker anyway. I had a heart attack. I damn near died. I don't need the headache. Now, you know, when I talked to Russ, he's like, Houston, you're a hustler. Go hustle. Don't write a book. Quit writing that book. Quit writing.
All right. We're going to talk to Houston about how the game ended and disastrously for him and some other people right after a few commercials. At South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. The South Point is closed now with basically every casino in the world. Predicted.org. It's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. The most active markets now are who's going to be the nominees for the elections and who will win. Gambler with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Triple Play Dream Card. Dream Card is a 10-coin per line game where periodically you receive a dream card, which is substituted for the best available card before the draw. There's no special strategy required, and the feature adds EV over whatever the base game paid. There are actually two versions of Dream Card out there. They look the same at the outset. You can look at the help screen for how often you get the Dream Card. In one version, the Dream Card comes more often and it's just a natural card. The other version, the Dream Card comes less often, but whenever that happens, three hands are dealt in the background that you can't see, and you get the best one. So it doesn't much matter which one you play, but it'll be a different experience as to how often you get the Dream Card, but your return will be approximately the same. We're now back to Houston, Curtis, talking about the game in Hollywood. Now,
hello.
There's this hedge fund manager who had a gambling problem, and you ended up having to pay for it. How did that all happen?
The first time I met Brad Runerman was actually out at Rick Solomon's beach house. I think he had leased a place for the summer out in Malibu. And Toby and I went out there for a game that was off our normal schedule. You know, it wasn't our game. And Brad happened to be there. And and we immediately recognized him as someone we needed in our game. So we got him in our game. And I'll never forget. It was a hand with Rick where Rick goes all in on the river on a stone bluff. He had nothing, no pair. He had jack high. And Runerman snap called him. This is on the river, mind you. Not the turn, not the flop. Snap called him, and Solomon's like, you got me. I just got jack high. I was bluffing. And he turns over his hand, and he had jack high also. So all he had was jack high. So Toby and I look at each other, and we're like, oh, man, we've got a live one. And a few weeks go by, and, I mean, this guy was just losing and losing and losing, it, like, huge numbers. So we pulled him aside, and we said, hey, man, you know, maybe you should think about getting some books or, you know, Houston's got some DVDs he produced, you know. And he's like, oh, yeah. In Molly's game, the movie, they make it – Molly takes the credit for that. And Jessica Chastain in the film has a conversation with him about trying to get him a poker tutor. That never happened. It was me and Toby who did that. So she just kind of took our story there. And he didn't seem to care. And we had three hedge fund guys in the game. And it was John Brooks and Mike Baxter. Every time you ask those guys, hey, how's the market? They're like, oh, you don't want to know. It's brutal. But every time you asked, yes, Brad, we're up another 2%. You know, he was always up. And I just thought he was some kind of an idiot savant because he was the worst poker player I've ever seen. He was like a gift from Zeus. Like Zeus carved him out of clay and made him come to life as the world's biggest donkey. And he lost six figures. I don't ever remember him losing less than six figures in a night, and he never won. I don't think he ever had one winning session.
Wow.
And that's almost, you know, I mean, I'd like to figure out the odds on that, but he never had one winning session. He played, you know, a few years, you know, and I guess we had got him for about $5.5 million total. And for whatever reason, a lot of his checks end up went to me, like close to $1 million of his check, $750,000, I think, went to me. It was probably because, you know, I never, you know, if we had a guest who was playing who won, we'd want them to get paid that night. And Ruderman never brought a check with him. He always paid like 2 days later. And since, you know, it was either going to be me or Toby that was going to take the check, and I knew Toby wasn't going to take it, so I just took it. And so when all this came out, you know, I was sitting at Alec Gore's house, and the game had already kind of, we'd already booted Molly to New York, which we can backtrack and talk about. But Ruderman was sitting there when the market was, just before the market was about to crash. And apparently it's true what they say, billionaires, they get all the good, juicy information, because I just remember casually sitting there and hearing Alec Gore, the billionaire, say, "Hey, Brad," he had $10 million with Brad in his fund. He said, my team's telling me that I should be pulling out of, you know, any kind of funds right now, based on the analysis of where the market's going. So I'm going to need to pull that $10 million. And then I didn't think much of it. And Brad's like, "Yeah, I'll have that for you, you know, by the end of the week." Well, 2 weeks later, Brad was in prison. And, I think when they got him, he had about $500,000 left. And then they, you know, they went to shake down Molly over some of the stuff she was, you know, she'd been started raking games at that point in New York, in a game that we handed her, by the way. She makes it seem like she was just fired. Our game moved to Alec's house, you know, a billionaire's house. So Toby did the right thing, and we had this guy, New York Cliff, come in and play, who was from the New York game. And Toby made the introduction and said, you should have Molly start hosting your game. So that's another reason I wanted to write this book. You know, she makes it look like Toby, you just fired her and told her to screw off and took her livelihood, when in fact, he served her up New York on a silver platter and handed it to her. And, you know, for her to say anything less than that, just, I don't know, seems criminal. But anyway, when they shook her down because she was raking games, she gave up all of our names. They basically gave her some leniency on the other crap that she was involved with in exchange for naming all the guys who had played with Ruderman and how much money each one of us had taken off of them. Well, for me, it was $750,000, and they don't care. As you guys know, in theory, that could have been, you know, I could have gotten a $50,000 check from him one night and lost $100,000 to him the next night. Now that never happened, but they didn't check the books at all. They just looked at numbers, and apparently there's some bankruptcy loophole that allowed them to come after everyone he had paid, because technically he was paying us with stolen money. You know, so the estate was coming after us. And what made it weird was Alec was on both sides of it. Alec Gore is the billionaire, had $10 million in his fund, but also had won money from him in the game. You know, so Alec put together, tried to get everybody. Toby didn't do it, and a few guys got their own attorneys, but I was already kind of going bust at that time. You know, this is on the tail end of everything, and the world was about to collapse. And so I said, "Yeah, I'll go in with you," because he was going to pay the first $80,000 in attorney's fees. Well, that $80,000 was eaten up in two conference calls. Apparently, they're really good attorneys. And then I read the fine print that said whoever carried the biggest debt would carry that portion percentage-wise of the ongoing attorney's fees. And I thought, oh, man, you know, what a – you know, so I just backed out, and I – you know, some guys settled for 50 cents on the dollar, some for 65. I couldn't settle at that point because of the other things that had happened in my life with, you know, my business, you know, distribution companies were going under. I mean, it was 2008, you know, the market had already crashed. My $3 million house was worth, you know, $1.1 million. So they put another $750,000 lien on my house. And, you know, at that point I was in like I went into a massive state of depression. It wasn't long after that I ended up having a heart attack and died on the table over at Cedar Sinai. You know, my master plan was going south, guys. It's going way south.
How's your health today?
By some kind of miracle, when I finally got out of L.A., you know, I moved to L.A. with nothing and was a self-made millionaire by the time I was 30. I was a multimillionaire in my early 40s. By like, I don't know, it's probably like 45 or so, I'd lost everything. I was literally, I borrowed 15 grand from John Moonves just to get out of, back to Illinois. And, you know, I was having, for the first time in my life, asking relatives to help me invest in projects that I needed to finish. And, you know, it was desperate times. And, and I got there. I was, when I left, I was told I had 5 years to live. They told me I literally needed to get my affairs in order. My heart was functioning. It had gone down from like 25% to like 22%. It was getting worse. And, it was cardiomyopathy, heart disease, and none of the medication that they had given me, it seemed to improve it at all. And I think that was the first time it really hit me, you know, how real it was. And that was like in a year, at least a year, if not 2 years after the actual initial heart attack. And, you know, I went into a massive depression and woe is me, you know, kind of zone. And they ended up, I couldn't sleep. I had nightmares and, my family was off in Boston and I'm back in Illinois. Couldn't even afford health insurance. I was on like, you know, government aid health insurance. And I started writing this book. And the more I got into this book, you know, the more kind of my spirits, I felt like I was, you know, not like I was back in it, but, you know, I was in a good headspace when I was writing the book. And the doctor had changed up my medication a little bit, you know, some country doctor, not one of these big fancy Hollywood Beverly Hills doctors that I'd been seeing. And, I get a call one day and the nurse was crying and I thought, man, this is going to be bad. And, because everyone in my little small town kind of knows me. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, Houston, but there's good news. We need you to come in right away. And I went in and the doctor, said, well, I don't know what to tell you, but it looks like we beat it. And I said, what do you mean? He said, your heart is back to normal. He said, somehow your heart is functioning. It's as healthy as mine. And I don't know, man. I think it was a miracle. And, you know, it was definitely a long shot. it was a longer shot than the one outer that Rick Solomon had hit me with for $1 million, that I would ever recover. And so I started living life again like I had a future. And you know, that's what I'm trying to do now.
And so now you are doing the website, and do you have other projects going on?
I've got a lot of stuff going on. I'm writing another, Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, as you know, out everywhere. I'm going to be doing some other stuff in relation to that. We're already talking to, you know, agents and companies about film rights, possible television series, and some other things related to it. I've also, for a long time, actually before I even started writing Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, I started writing Million Dollar Mechanics and started talking to Anthony Curtis about it. And he read a sample of it, showed it to some, you know, people he trusted, and came back and said, wow, you are the real deal. And I said, I told you. And so we're doing that, and I'm really excited about that. So I built cardsharp.com with a K, to kind of be the, you know, the video version of that. I'm doing free tutorials on my YouTube channel, which you can, you know, you can get to by going to my website. And, I'm starting to do, private, you know, lessons, Skype lessons, I have students from all over the world right now. So it's pretty exciting.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about yet, Hollywood is known for, among other things, pretty girls and drugs. Did any of that go on in the game?
No.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, there was one thing I will say, Toby was very adamant about trying to keep too much, you know, shenanigans away from him personally, because he didn't want to be associated with any scandal. And unfortunately, that backfired on him in a big way. But, you know, he was always, he never wanted to be associated with a scandal. But, you know, those, when the girls come in, it's usually later at night anyway. And Toby was always the first to leave when he was up. And, yeah, I saw some crazy stuff. I mean, there was a record producer who had two hookers. He would keep them, like two doors down at the Four Seasons, and he was throwing the whole party for the game. And he would take a break. He would go down. He'd be gone for like 30 minutes, and then he'd come back, and then he'd dump some more money, and then he'd be gone for 30. And we'd literally just sit there waiting for him. And, at one point, and I knew what he was doing, but at one point I'm like, dude, where are you going? What's so important that you got to leave the game? And he's like, oh, I didn't tell you, dude. And he's like, oh, yeah, I've got two hookers in there that they're snorting, blow off my, you know what? And, he's like, I'm not going to miss that. So yeah, that kind of stuff happens. After parties started happening, you know, Molly started partying a lot. One guy, I think, brought two twins once. I had never seen that. But a really funny story, a celebrity-based kind of story, is when we were still at the Viper Room, right before we were going to the Four Seasons and the Beverly Hills Hotel, Joe Francis was in the game. You guys know who he is, the Girls Gone Wild creator? He created all the
I know what Girls Gone Wild are.
Yeah, well, Joe was like a kind of like a big kid. He made a bunch of money at a young age with this Girls Gone Wild, and you know, he was in with the whole Hollywood crowd. He, you know, he would always be running with the Paris Hiltons and the, you know, all the it kids of Hollywood or whatever. And we're playing one night, and Mary Kate Olsen, I think it was whichever one had the drug and rehab issues. I think it was Mary Kate. If it was Ashley. Yeah, they're twins. I mean, I can't remember, and I never really followed them. But the one who is more of the partier shows up. I believe it's Mary Kate Olsen. And we never let people watch, but, you know, when another celebrity, you know, wants to watch, I guess it's okay. And as soon as she got there, Joe Francis is like, hey, how you doing, baby? And she said, do I know you? And he immediately said, well, you sure knew me when you were snorting blow off my cock in the limo. And, I mean, a hush went through the room.
I'll bet.
Yeah, it was like dead silent, like, you know, it was a gasp. And then about 5 seconds, seemed like the longest 5 seconds ever, Toby started kind of uncontrollably laughing under his breath. He was like, and then I looked at him and I burst out laughing, and then everyone was laughing, and she stormed out, you know, upset, obviously. And it was just one of those moments that could only happen, you know, and it seemed like it would happen in a movie. But it was very funny.
You know, I'm interested in because of your background with card manipulation, you mentioned a few incidents where you were suspicious of games that you were in, not Molly's game, but other games that you were in. And I'm just wondering how much cheating you ran into out there in L.A. or in games in Vegas.
Well, I'll tell you this much, and I don't say this in I'm the most non-racist person from the Midwest, at least, that you'll ever meet. But every game that I played in, whether Russian or Armenian, to my recollection, was crooked in Los Angeles. I'd never played one that there wasn't something going on in the game that wasn't crooked. And sometimes I would be partnered with the right people on that, but a lot of times I was a lone wolf in these games. And I could assess the situation pretty quickly. And I'll never forget one night I was playing with these Russian guys. And I'm not going to say any names, but I was playing with these Russian guys. And they were like low-level guys. They weren't like big, you know, Russian mob guys. But they were obviously kind of, at least thought they were mobbed up to some degree. And they were, you know, there was like three of them. I could tell after about two orbits who was in on the scam. So I was pretty much playing straight up poker, but I was, they weren't using a shuffle master, and the dealer didn't look like he could handle the deck very well, but I knew that there was, you know, definite collusion going on in some limited knowledge, like riffle stacking and stuff like that. And whenever I saw it, and you know, if you know how to look for these things, you can spot a guy who's doing a bad riffle stack, you know, you spot it every time, you just fold your hand. So I did a holdout. You guys know what a holdout is?
I do.
Put a card up your sleeve.
Yeah, basically I palmed off in like a gambler's cop position, two cards that I held back from the muck. I held them back one at a time from different hands. And but I didn't want to have them in my hand that long. I was ready to, you know, do a switch, put them in play, and then when I went to muck, I was going to muck all four cards. You know, so I'd held out two aces, and these guys didn't seem like, you know, super creative guys. So, you know, I was just going to wait for a moment, and I probably should have held out, you know, two eights and, you know, just waited to hit a set. But I held out the aces in case the set never came and I just needed a big hand to scoop a pot. And because I just had balls of steel, I was younger, and, you know, I probably didn't really realize how dangerous it was what I was doing. But I was cocky and confident. And but as soon as I hold the cards out, this kind of like waitress walks in and does like a whisper in the dealer's ear, like she's trying to tell him something. And there was like a deck switch happened. There was a lot of table talk going on, and guys got up, moving around, moving their hands around. You know, it was like a worst display of misdirection I'd ever seen. And she does a deck switch. So now I'm sitting there holding these two aces, and I can't put them in because they just switched the deck. You know, otherwise, you know, it could
right,
be like
wrong color.
No, it was not a deck switch like a deck change. It was the same color. It was basically he had finished shuffling the cards and she was ringing in a cooler.
Oh, Jesus.
So she's ringing in a cooler, but I'm doing a holdout. And there was this one other guy there, and I never liked seeing like guys who, I don't know. Yeah, I don't mean to sound like Robin Hood or whatever, like rob from the rich and give to the poor, but they had a guy in there that was playing way beyond his means, and they were just burying the kid. And I mean, he was about in tears, and they were going to go after him. I knew they were going after him on this hand. and he ends up with aces. Because I was sitting to his was I to his left? I think I was to his right, and I saw his cards all night. And he was just so bad. He held his cards up, you know, how an amateur does. And they did, and one of the aces was the same one of the aces that I had. So I thought, I'm going to save this kid some money, and I'm going to play this hand because I know he's not going to let go of those aces. So I played it, and we turned the hand over, and as soon as we did, someone yelled, "Oh, it's the chop pot," and I was like, "Wait a minute, what the f's going on here, guys? There's two ace of diamonds in this deck." And they start, you know, mumbling, and one guy's like, "No, there isn't. No, there is." I'm like, "Look." And then I started making a huge stink about it. And one guy stood up and kind of got my face a little bit, and he had a gun. He didn't pull it out or anything, but you could see that he was packing a gun. And I just said, "Look, I want my money back. I think you should give this kid his money back, and let's just call it a night." And, you know, I said, "Otherwise, you know, give me this, you know, decide who's going to win this, this pot, you know, cause I want to," it was like a $20,000 pot. I was like, I want at least half the pot. They stopped the game. They told me to leave, and I just said, "Screw it." And I left. I don't know what happened to the kid. You know, I don't know if I did him a favor or not. But 3 or 4 days later, I started getting followed. And these guys followed me all the way from my office to my house. And I was like, "Oh, man." And I got out. And this is like a nice house, like in Sherman Oaks. Like, literally, I've got Pink. The rock singer Pink lives two houses down. Melissa Joan Hart, the Sabrina the Teenage Witch, lives across the street. Saul Sachs, the guy who created Bewitched, lives like right across from me. It was a nice little area. Not the kind of area where you'd see like mobbed up Russians. And they get out of the car as soon as I pull up, and they walked up to me, and I was like, you know, I saw my life flash before my eyes. And the guy said, "You left the game, you forgot something." And I said, "What's that?" And he reached out and he handed me $10,000. And I just said, "Well, thank you." And he said, "No, thank you for never mentioning our game to anybody." Wow. It was like right out of a movie. And wow. That was probably the scaredest I've ever been in any kind of cheating situation. But, you know, they may read this and now know that I held out those cards, but they're never going to, like, I'm not scared those guys would ever come after me because I haven't named their names. And back then, you know, I wasn't really known, and there was no one else in the game that I, you know, really talked to on a real regular basis today. You know, there's a few guys that, you know, we all know what that game was, and they know no one's going to say anything. So I'm not worried they're going to come after me. What would they be coming after me for? You know, 10 grand. The game is probably dead anyway.
So we're out of time again. This has been a lot of fun. And Houston, you're a great interview. Can't wait till your book with Anthony comes out.
Thank you, guys.
We have time for one recommend. And this is a while ago by the time you hear this, but on April 13th, James Grosjean published a little article on gamblingwithanedge.com. Now, James Grosjean is a magical name mm-hmm. to most of our listeners.
He's like a unicorn.
And so if you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing it. As of now, which is 3 days after that, which is quite a bit before you're going to see this, there's 36 comments, of which about 10 are from James. So people do something and then say something, and then he'll respond to them. And so for a lot of listeners, this is a great dialogue that you probably want to check out.
Wow. So
that is all the recommends we have time for today. Houston, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And guys, if anyone, I just want to throw out to your listeners, if anyone has any questions and they want to go on your site and pose them, I will check in and I'll try to answer anything I can.
Hot damn. That's great.
That's great. Thanks.
The book, absolutely.
The book is called Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist.
By the way, I just want to add also, when he says that, he's talking about gamblingwithanedge.com. So a lot of people listen to these shows on different sites, YouTube or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. But if you want to pose a question, you can't be checking every site for questions.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So gamblingwithanedge.com. I'll be there.
Yeah.
I am. So thank you, Houston.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.